This is Fresh Air Weekend. I am Terry Gross. The musicals Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and Passion are usually called Stephen Sondheim musicals. And of course, Sondheim is widely acknowledged as the most innovative and brilliant Broadway composer and lyricist of our time. But there's someone else who was essential in the creation of those three shows, and he is my guest, James Lapine. He wrote the books for each of those musicals and directed the original Broadway productions. Sunday in the Park with George won a Pulitzer Prize for drama. Lapine won a Tony for the book of Into the Woods. Lapine also co-wrote the book with William Finn for Falsettos. The book of a musical is like a libretto. It's the part that's spoken, not sung. But some of Sondheim's songs were inspired by or borrowed from lines written by Lapine for the show's books. Now Lapine has written a book, the kind that you read. It's called Putting It Together, How Stephen Sondheim and I Created Sunday in the Park with George. It's a fascinating behind-the-scenes account featuring Lapine's reminiscences and his interviews with many people who worked on the show, including Sondheim, the show's stars Bernadette Peters and Mandy Patinkin, as well as other cast members, producers, orchestrators, set designers, and more. James Lapine, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the shows that you did with Sondheim, and it is just a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Sunday in the Park is a work of art about a work of art. For people unfamiliar with the show, just describe the premise.
Well, it was inspired by a painting by Georges Seurat in 1884 to 1886, 2 years it took for him to paint a Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte, and it employed his methodology of pointillism in creating art. And it was ironic because we were 100 years later ending up writing a show about the making of that painting, and it took Seurat 2 years to paint the painting, and it took us 2 years to write the show.
The initial idea for the show was sparked by you bringing in some images to look at with Sondheim, which strikes me as a very strange way to start a musical, to look at pictures. But you used to be a graphic designer and did graphic design and posters for Yale Repertory Theater. And one of the images you brought in was a postcard of the painting that inspired the show. So you put the postcard down, you and Sondheim gazed at this postcard of the painting by Seurat. And how did that lead to Sunday in the Park?
Well, it was an image that I used in the very first thing I did in the theater, which was a very abstract show by Gertrude Stein called Photograph. And in that, I used several famous images, one of which was this painting. So I was pretty familiar with it. And when we sat down to look at it together, along with other images that I brought in, Steve immediately said it looks like a stage set. And from there, we just sat and talked about it and realized all the strange details that are in the painting, the peculiar perspective of the painting, that the characters were not looking at one another, and why is there a monkey there? And I don't know, somehow I blurted out, well, there's one person missing, and he said, who? And I said, the artist. And somehow that just sparked an idea that this could somehow be a theatrical venture.
So you realize that the character missing in this painting was the artist himself, and he became the main character in the show, along with his muse and model, the character played by Bernadette Peters. So why don't we hear Sunday in the Park, the opening song from Sunday in the Park with George.
George. Why is it you always get to sit in the shade while I have to stand in the sun? Hello, George. There is someone in this dress. A trickle of sweat. The back of the head. He always does this. Now the foot is dead. Sunday in the Park with George. One more. The collar is damp. Beginning to pinch. The bustle slipping. I won't budge one inch. Who was at the zoo, George? cold. That's you, George, you're Miss Fixed Cold. I like that in a man. Fixed Cold. God, it's hot out here. Well, there are worse things than staring at the water on a Sunday. There are worse things than staring at the water as you're posing for a picture being painted by your lover in the middle of the summer on an island in the river on a Sunday.
That's the opening song from Sunday in the Park with George, music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim, and the book for the show, written by my guest James Lapine, who also directed the show, and now he has a new book called Putting It Together, How Stephen Sondheim and I Created Sunday in the Park with George. As you've said, like, Sondheim is a very slow writer when it comes to writing songs. Did you worry, once it was a sure thing that you were going to do this show together, did you worry that he wouldn't finish in time? And are there things you would try to do to kind of nudge him to work a little faster?
You know, he used to say to me I don't remember when, one day he said to me, look, James, do you want it Tuesday or do you want it good? And of course, I think I said I want it Tuesday and I want it good. But the anxiety was there, certainly, when we got to the second act of the show on Broadway with people paying money to see it. And one of the revelations of writing this book, I could not understand why it took him so long. And when I interviewed Steve about it, these many years later, he couldn't really explain why it took him so long and whether it was a psychological issue or whatever. But what I did in writing this book was dive into all of his paperwork on the show. And I realized that these two songs, one of which ended up being very, very short, he had done pages and pages and pages of writing lyrics and lyric ideas on these two songs. And it wasn't like he was sitting around at home having an anxiety attack. He was working and sorting out and being who he is, which is a perfectionist, and wanting them to be perfect and perfect for the show. And once I saw that, when I was writing this book, I realized it wasn't a psychological issue at all. It was just, he knew the importance of these two numbers, and he didn't want to let go of them till he thought they were perfect.
You know, you write that Sondheim was in a bad place when you first met, because Merrily We Roll Along had just closed after a short run. It didn't get great reviews. And he was even thinking about leaving theater because he thought theater was just too cruel. I'm wondering what it was like for you to meet him when he was feeling so discouraged and you were just starting your career in theater.
You know, I said something so profoundly stupid to him at that first meeting when he was kind of painting a very dark picture of how he was feeling about the theater and particularly the show that had closed. And I said, well, I'm sure if you wanted to sit here and think of a very commercial idea, you know, we could, and we could write a successful show. And he just looked at me and he said, I would never do that.
Yeah. He probably wouldn't know how to do that. I mean, he writes what he writes and it's brilliant.
Exactly.
Wait, I'm going to take that back, that he probably could do that, because in so many of his shows, there are like songs in the manner of Harold Arlen or Gershwin or Berlin. Like, he knows how to write in different voices and how to incorporate that in his shows. And it brings a certain like period meeting or just an interesting tribute, or, you know, so he probably could do that, but I'm sure he wouldn't.
Well, he sort of did, and it was called Into the Woods. I mean,
Oh, really? Do you think of that as like an intentionally commercial show?
No, but as we were working on it, he said, you know, this, I don't remember what his exact words, but he did realize as he was writing that it had commercial value, let's put it that way, because we were working with fairy tales and we were working with a subject that was kind of universal to people.
The only Sondheim show that you'd go, hey, bring the kids.
Just to the first act, yeah. I think, frankly, in the back of my head, I was thinking kind of commercially about Into the Woods. I had just had a kid, and and I was fascinated with fairy tales, and I guess when I say commercial, I think what we're really saying is very accessible. You know, a show that would be very accessible to people in the way that Sunday, you know, you had to work a little bit if you came to see Sunday in the Park with George.
Can you think of a revelation that came to you from something Sondheim said that you may not have realized or thought of without him?
I think what I learned most from him is the marriage of music to spoken word. And the one maybe major thing he said to me was, let me take care of theme. I can put things in a song that no one will blanch at, that you put in a scene, and it will scream out as being thematic. It will be cliche if you're trying to say something about, you know, beauty or whatever. And, you know, that's why no one knows who book writers are, because if it's a good musical, you know the music. And that's why you go to see it. And your job as a book writer, ostensibly, is to tell a story and connect it song to song. But what people don't realize in the way Steve works is, and why he didn't write a song until the first act was finished, is because he melds the two. He robs from his book writers. And it's a back and forth conversation as to what the character and what the theme of the show is and how it's expressed. And mostly a lot of that is expressed in music.
Okay, so that's really interesting. Can you think of one of Sondheim's songs that you and he agreed should be an emotion or a thematic point that was expressed in the show, but it would sound too corny or sentimental or on the nose if it was actually spoken as opposed to sung?
I would say Finishing the Hat is a perfect example of that, of a song that comes at a perfect place in the act that lets an audience see this kind of cold, distant character and allows us to understand what he's going through and what his process is and who he is and the pain he feels. But I think what Steve's genius is also on what I guess I would call spotting a musical. You know, he had the first act, but he was often the one to know where there needed to be a song and what that song needed to be about.
And part of what this song is about is how difficult it is to create a work of art, but when you've created it, there's something there that had never been there before. You created something that didn't exist before. And if you made that in a speech, it might sound like a little much.
Hey, yeah, corny yeah. City. Well, also there's another level to that song, which is him examining what he's given up to make something. You know, what the choices are, what you do with your time and your passion, and how you have to distance yourself from other temptations to keep your focus entirely on this vision that you have to bring to fruition.
Okay, well, let's hear it. So this is from Sunday in the Park with George.
Finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from a window while you finish the hat. Mapping out a sky. What you feel like planning a sky. What you feel when voices that come through the window till they distance and die, until there's nothing but sky, and how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light, how the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to the night, dizzy from the height, coming from the hat.
I want to talk with you a little bit about Into the Woods, another really like beloved show. I think the idea was yours to do a musical based on fairy tales, and it's a kind of mashup of several fairy tales. Can you talk about the genesis of the idea?
Well, Steve and I met to write another show, and it was interesting because we had an opportunity to make a film of Sunday in the Park after the Broadway run, and I was kind of excited at that idea because I always wanted to direct a film, but he really wanted to write a show, so we decided to put our energy into that. And we just sat together and kind of discussed ideas, and he was kind of interested in like a quest musical in which people were, he was oddly enough very into video games at the time, and I was kind of interested in writing a fairy tale, and I kind of had a whole Jungian kind of period of my life, and Steve's knowledge of fairy tales was strictly the Disney cartoons. And so I said, well, I'm going to try to write a fairy tale and see if we can make a musical of it. And I did sit down and started writing a fairy tale, and I realized, oh, fairy tales are very short. You read the Grimm brothers, you read Perrault, they're not very long. They're just a few pages long. And I realized, oh, they're really not meant to be, fleshed out in a way. They're kind of shorthand, and often the plot turns on a dime. The idea of having an original fairy tale along with existing fairy tales came to be. And that's how we started. And it was the complete opposite of the Sunday process. I sat down and wrote this opening scene that involved, like four different fairy tale characters. And I handed it to him, and I said, there's no way you can make this an opening number. And, of course, in retrospect, I realized that's the exact way to get Sondheim to do something, is tell him it can't be done. And lo and behold, he musicalized the whole thing, and we were off to the races.
So let's hear some of the prologue from Into the Woods.
Once upon a time, in a far-off kingdom,
more than anything,
lived a fair maiden, a sad young lad,
I wish,
and a childless baker.
More than life,
I wish,
with his
more
wife.
More than anything,
more than the moon,
I wish.
The king is giving a festival.
More than life,
I wish.
I wish to go to the festival.
More than riches,
I wish my cow would give us some milk.
More than anything,
I wish we had a child.
Please, pal.
Child.
Please,
pal. I wish to go to the
I wish you give us a wish for
I have a child.
I wish. You wish to go to the festival?
The poor girl's mother had died.
You, Cinderella, the festival.
What
you wish to go to the festival?
The festival?
The king's festival?
And her father had taken for his new wife
the festival.
A woman with two daughters of her own.
Look at your nails.
Look at your dress.
People would laugh at you.
Nevertheless,
she still wants to go to the festival
and dance before the prince.
All three were beautiful of face, but vile and black of heart. Jack, on the other hand, had no father, and his mother,
I wish,
well, she was not quite beautiful.
I wish myself.
That's an excerpt of the prologue from Into the Woods, and my guest, James Lapine, wrote the book for the musical and directed the original Broadway production. He also adapted the book for the film version of it. Are you and Sondheim still good friends?
Oh, my God, yeah. I consider him one of my absolute closest friends.
I'm glad to hear that.
I'm very lucky. And when you go through what we went through on those three shows, you are joined at the hip for life.
How did you decide not to collaborate anymore?
That's an interesting question, and one I ask myself, and one I've asked him, too. I don't know why we didn't do more work together. We certainly tried. I had projects that I was interested in doing, and he had projects that he was interested in doing, and neither gelled for the other. And I tried my hand at some of the things he wanted to do, and it just was an odd thing. And particularly the last show I have written, which is about LSD, which I thought he could have done just an incredible, created something incredible for that. But for whatever reason, he couldn't relate to it, and didn't choose to do it. So, you know, I did the musical review, Sondheim on Sondheim, and I did a documentary on him, Six by Sondheim, because I wanted to be involved with him, even if I didn't get to write a show. So to that end, here I've written a book about him too. So, you know, in a way, I feel he's never left my life. We just haven't been able to really find a show together to do.
Why don't we end with a song? Is there a song from any of the shows that you worked on with Sondheim that you feel just kind of speaks to the moment we're in now?
I definitely think the song No One Is Alone from Into the Woods is one that we should all be listening to.
Well, let's end with that. James Lapine, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for your work.
Oh, my gosh, and thank you for yours, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
James Lapine's new book is called Putting It Together, How Stephen Sondheim and I Created Sunday in the Park with George.
Mother cannot guide you. Now you're on your own. Only me beside you. Still, you're not alone. No one is alone. Truly, no one is alone. Sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood. Others may deceive you.
Prince died in 2016, but the Prince Estate has opened its vault to release a completely new album recorded in 2010 called Welcome to America. It surprised early listeners with its numerous songs containing political messages, which was unusual for Prince. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the music speaks very much to the America of today.
Anybody close enough to hear knows what we've been listening to all year. These are the days my people told me to fear. As long as I got your ear, I think it's gonna be hot summer.
Hot summer, yeah.
Just wait and see. Hot summer.
Hot summer, yeah.
Shoo-dee-doo-dee. Hot summer.
As long as
you're my company.
How wonderful it is to hear new Prince music. Especially something as warm and catchy and goofy as Hot Summer, complete with shooby-doobies in the refrain. It's one of the tossed-off pleasures of Welcome to America. Who knows why Prince opted to hide it away more than a decade ago, but this album's arrival now makes it sound very much of the moment.
We can live underwater. It ain't hard when you've never been apart. Of the country on dry land. We used to be smarter. We taught them what they knew, and now we got to show them what it means to be American.
Good life,
good life, liberty, innovation,
innovation.
Every child, no matter what color,
getting an education.
Education. Now life in the hood is nothing to fear.
1,000 light years old.
About a peaceful
thousand light years away from me.
That's 1,000 light years from here. When he sings about being underwater, it's more than possible he was referring to the financial crisis of the years immediately preceding his 2010 recording date. But that song's lyrics about what it means to be an American ring out now with even more irony than Prince intended. The title song has his backup singers harmonize on the phrase, "Land of the free, home of the slave." And the third verse of "One Day We Will All Be Free" offers what could be heard now as Prince's take on critical race theory.
You go to
to school just to learn about what never existed.
If your history only burns, it's better to resist it.
Keeping it Franklin, Benjamin Banneker was never born a slave.
And if George Washington never told no lie, maybe we'd all be
political content in some of these songs is unusual in Prince's body of work, and it's important, therefore, to consider the context in which this music was made. Prince was recording these songs, skeptical of the possibility of social justice, during the first term of Barack Obama, which was a period filled with hope for the very citizens Prince frequently says here are being denied hope. This dubiousness on Prince's part reminds me of one of the few prominent black skeptics of Obama during this time, the public intellectual Dr. Cornel West, who in a funny way figures specifically in this album. People involved in the recording process have said Prince was in the habit of watching videos of Cornel West, who at one point in a speech said, "I love my brother Prince, but he's no Curtis Mayfield." Prince took this as a challenge, writing and recording Born to Die, with Prince offering Curtis Mayfield-style social commentary in a very Curtis Mayfield falsetto.
She sells everything, A to Z, anything just to keep her free from the hustle of the streets. She left the church a long time ago, said they couldn't teach what they did not know. That's when she lost her virginity. And now she's pimping every motto from New York to L.A. Ask her why she do that thing. She says it's always been that way. Jump back, Jack, you might be next if you try to cut mama's cake.
What the deal, Daddy?
And ask her what the deal is.
This is what she says.
In a way, Welcome to America is a perfect companion piece to Summer of Soul, Questlove's new documentary about a 1969 concert that encapsulated the whole of 60s rhythm and blues, reintroducing it to young folks in 2021. In a similar way, the inspirations for the songs on Welcome to America look back to older music that influenced Prince, while the lyrics look ahead to the future we inhabit now.
Ken Tucker reviewed the new posthumously released Prince album called Welcome to America. My guest, Cecily Strong, is nominated for an Emmy for the second year in a row for her work on Saturday Night Live. She also stars in the new series Schmigadoon, which is a very smart, funny, and loving satire of musicals from the 40s and 50s. Strong joined SNL as a featured player in 2012. In her second season, she co-anchored Weekend Update with Seth Meyers and then Colin Jost. But she left the desk, preferring to do sketch comedy, which she's great at. Her characters have included Fox News host Judge Jeanine Pirro, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Melania Trump, and the girl you wish you hadn't started a conversation with at a party. Strong also has a new book that will be published tomorrow called This Will All Be Over Soon. It's a journal of her first year of the pandemic, dealing with anxiety and depression. Let's start with Schmigadoon, which is filled with references to classic musicals like Oklahoma, Carousel, The Music Man, The Sound of Music, and of course, Brigadoon. It's streaming on Apple TV+. Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key star as a couple trying to reinvigorate their relationship by going on a hike designed for couples who need to reconnect. They get lost in the woods, cross over a bridge, and suddenly find themselves on what looks like a backlot movie set of a small town in the early 20th century, a town called Schmigadoon. The women are wearing long, colorful prairie dresses with big petticoats. The men are dressed like they're in old-fashioned barbershop quartets. The townspeople are singing and dancing as if they're in an old musical. Cecily Strong's character loves musicals and is initially charmed. Keegan-Michael Key's character hates musicals and is desperate to leave. But they both soon realize they're trapped in Schmigadoon, where life is a musical. A leprechaun has explained to the couple, in song, that they can't leave Schmigadoon until they find true love, which means the depth of their love is about to be tested. In this scene, the couple keeps trying to cross the bridge and escape Schmigadoon while bickering about their relationship.
I don't understand. Why couldn't we cross?
I mean...
What?
Look, this whole thing is insane. I'm still trying to wrap my head around all of it, but apparently, according to the leprechaun, this isn't true love.
So, you don't really love me?
I didn't say that. Of course I love you.
Then what are you saying?
I'm not saying anything, but apparently some cosmic verdict has been reached and we failed. That's all.
So you're ready to give up on us because of what a leprechaun said?
No, stop. I am just trying to figure out how to get out of here and get back to reality.
But not together.
We already tried together.
So what? Wait, you want to try with other people?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Please, no song. I'll do anything.
Guys, we're actually in the middle of something.
You can't plow a field without hitting some stones.
Every stake's bound to have some fat.
You can't eat a fish without getting some bones.
And you can't have love without having a lover's fat.
Would you leave us alone for just a minute?
Seriously, please.
First she says something bound to get his gander.
Then he says something mean to get her back.
Then she complains that he don't understand her.
And then he gives her a smack.
No, oh no, that's not okay. Unless it's consensual.
It's just a lover's fat.
Cecily Strong, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the show so much. It's brought me such pleasure at a time when I think we all need some pleasure. So how much do you love musicals?
Well, first of all, just thank you for saying that. I think there's nothing more thrilling than hearing Terry Gross likes your show and enjoys it and has joy from it. I'm also love the show and get a lot of joy from it. I've always loved musicals. I mean, I think it's certainly been a part of my life since I was little. You know, my grandmother would buy me musicals on VHS, and that's what I'd always rent whenever we go to the movie store. And then my uncle is also a Broadway producer, so I've gotten to see a lot of his shows in New York.
And he's not just a Broadway producer. He's like a really big Broadway producer.
Yes, thank you.
Like, among the shows he did was terrific revivals of Music Man, which is, of course, referenced in Schmigadoon, and also a terrific revival of How to Succeed in Business, a Sondheim tribute. So you must have had this idea early on that being in shows was something real people did. I mean, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I thought people in movies and on Broadway were like from another planet. Like, they didn't connect to the world I lived in. They just performed, you know.
Sure. And I think you're probably not wrong. It feels like a little bit of other planet behavior, all of us. Yeah, I guess I knew it as a job. And I always wanted to be an actor since I was little. I think I took my first drama class when I was 3. Well, my parents put me in one, I should say. It's not like I drove myself. But I was just always performing around the house, and so I think they thought that might be a good outlet for me, and I wound up never stopping. And I think my uncle probably didn't want me to be an actor as much as I did, just knowing that it was a tough life.
Yeah, yeah. When you were going to see musicals that your uncle produced,
yeah,
did you get to meet the actors? Did you get to go backstage?
I did, and I mean, not always. I saw Guys and Dolls. I saw Once Upon a Mattress, which I absolutely loved and really wanted to do. But I certainly remember getting to go backstage after Secret Garden. And actually, my dad took a bunch of pictures. I met Daisy Egan. And my mom made a little poster for me for my room growing up that said Cecily on Broadway, and she used the playbill and a lot of those pictures. And I had that above my bed until we moved out, I think, till I went to college.
So your character in Schmigadoon is initially really charmed by the idea that they're like living in a world of a musical. And the first morning that you're there, you're having breakfast on the porch, and you're being, you know, waited on by a very lovely, very young waitress, and she recommends the corn pudding. And you go like, whoa, what's that? And it's like, you don't know what corn pudding is? And so I want to play that scene because it'll give a sense of how people just kind of break out into song around you and how you sometimes just chime right in. And so we'll hear Cecily Strong doing a little solo in part of this as Keegan-Michael Key objects to her participation. So here's another scene from Schmigadoon.
They want us to take a verse.
I'm not singing, and you're not singing.
Come on, could be fun.
No, do not.
Never had corn pudding.
Why?
And it may be a waste, but if you've got some extra.
Extra?
I sure would like a taste.
Oh, she sure would like a taste.
That was so weird. It was like as soon as I started singing, I knew what to say.
That's fantastic. Can we please go now?
What? Why?
Are you serious? The entire town and you just spent the last 5 minutes singing about corn pudding.
Did somebody say corn pudding?
That's it. We're leaving.
Okay. Well, that one's on you.
That was another scene from Schmigadoon, which stars my guest Cecily Strong and Keegan-Michael Key. God, this whole musical is so much fun. It's such a contrast for me seeing the joy in Schmigadoon, because everyone in it seems to be enjoying being in it so much, and I was enjoying watching it so much. And the contrast between that and the depression and anxiety you describe in your memoir, which a lot of your memoir is about living through the pandemic, like the first almost year of the pandemic, and you shot Schmigadoon during the pandemic. What was it like for you to go from this heightened sense of anxiety and depression to flying to Vancouver? Was it Vancouver?
Yeah.
To shoot and be in these like exuberant, like joyful production scenes.
I said no, actually, at first to going to Vancouver and shooting because I really was afraid. You know, and then it took a while to really understand, here's all of the things we're going to put in place, here's all the safety measures, until I finally felt safe. And then it was just such a gift. You know, it really, we talk about escapism, and I had real life escapism, where I flew into this beautiful, magical land of Vancouver, where there's like water and mountains and big trees. It was gorgeous. And then to be on those sets that were also gorgeous, and then to be with this amazing group of people, and we are able to do musicals in a time when Broadway is shuttered, and that's so depressing to walk next to. You know, there were a lot of tears on set, happy tears, just so much love and so much joy, and such, we were all just so honored to be there, and it felt like we got to share this magical thing. And you know, everybody that was there was supposed to be there. It kind of felt like that a little bit. And I think a lot of that, you can feel it when you watch the show, and I think that's probably why I enjoy rewatching it so much, is just taking myself back there.
Had you been vaccinated when you shot the series?
No, because I mean, we shot in last fall, so that wasn't even, I didn't even know we'd get to be vaccinated. So we just were relying on testing.
Well, you're nominated for an Emmy, second year in a row. That's pretty great. So let's talk a little bit about your work on Saturday Night Live. I think my favorite character that you've been doing lately is Judge Jeanine Pirro, the Fox News host. You just really got her down. Was it your idea to do her, or did someone say, oh, you should do her?
No, I think it was probably Brian Tucker, who I write with, and I wound up writing a lot of my update characters with him, or sort of those, anybody that's a real person. You know, I write Marjorie Taylor Greene with him, and we did Sidney Powell together this year, too. We were in his office, and he was like, have you seen this lady? And he was showing me clips of her, like, doing man on the street interviews. But she kept going, what? And it would like end in some crazy like exclamation. And we just thought it was so funny. And it was a fun way to play her. And we wrote a sketch actually that didn't make it onto the show. It went to dress and not to air. And then kind of like, well, I don't know that we'll ever get to do that again. It's hard. You have to do people that everybody knows. Otherwise, it's hard to get an impression on the show. Luckily for us, but maybe who knows for the greater world. Someone else can judge, luckily or not. But she became more popular and more of a household name. So we did her on Update. And actually, I flew out of the chair the first time because, you know, I hadn't done much physical comedy on the show at all. So I really was like, come on, everybody. I have to practice this fall. And I was so, like, mad that no one was letting me have my rehearsal. Because at Update, you only get to rehearse on Saturday, really.
So let's hear a clip of you doing Jeanine Pirro. This was performed after Pirro made anti-Muslim remarks about Representative Ilhan Omar. So here you are on Weekend Update as Judge Jeanine Pirro.
Fox News personality Judge Jeanine Pirro returned to television tonight after being suspended 2 weeks for controversial comments about a Muslim congresswoman. Here to explain is Jeanine Pirro.
Jeanine Pirro, and it's up to you to decide just what my whole deal is.
That's great. So you're back on Fox.
That's right. This Mueller report completely exonerated the president, and therefore everybody on the Trump train. Woo, woo! So somebody at Fox News said my name into a bathroom mirror 3 times, and here I am. And Colin, I just want to take this opportunity to say hi to my super fans out there. Mean, horny men laying on in-home hospital beds and white prison gangs who control the remote on Saturdays. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, you know, I don't have to shout. You know, I can hear you.
Can't do it, pal. Mama's got one volume, and it's 3 Chardonnays deep at a crowded party.
That's Cecily Strong as Judge Jeanine Pirro. That's just so funny. What did you do to try to capture her voice?
We definitely loved the exclamations, you know, saving those for the what? And then just being loud and over-enunciating and trying to have a stern look. You know, she's always got a very gravely serious affectation.
There's times on Update when Colin Jost has been laughing like so hard because you're so funny. And is it hard for you to keep a straight face when he's having trouble keeping a straight face?
I almost enjoy it more to see when someone's laughing. Then I kind of want to like go further. And, you know, there's still an element of like you're playing with your friends. And it is... It still feels a bit like controlled chaos on Update, especially where it feels kind of fresh and we're not exactly sure what's going to happen. And so it makes me want to like poke harder. If I think that he's laughing at something, I want to hit that harder.
Reports are that you're not sure whether you're going back to SNL in the fall.
Right.
Have you decided?
I haven't. Even though that seems crazy to say in the middle of summer, I think it's been a wild couple of years. And so I'm just, I'm okay with not knowing.
So when does the decision have to be made? I mean, the season starts, what, in late September usually?
Yes. So, I mean, I assume it'll have to be soon, and I'll meet, you know, I'll probably talk to Lauren more and talk to my agents, and we'll figure out where I'll be. So I would love to do it. So I just don't know for sure yet.
Whatever you decide to do about Saturday Night Live, I wish you well.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Cecily Strong stars in the new series, Schmigadoon, which is now streaming on Apple TV+. She's nominated for an Emmy for her work on Saturday Night Live.